Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of a beautiful podcast. How you doing? I am super. Thanks for asking. I'm stoked as can be about the upcoming Spring One Tour installment in May. That's free, by the way, and it's going to be a lot of fun. There's 2 days. The first day is going to be just a traditional talk. It's a 90-minute-ish talk, and that's going to be jam-packed. Don't miss that. All your all the things you want to know about when it comes to Spring and Kubernetes, we're going to be talking about that. We've been working hard on that. There's also day two, which is a workshop, right? And so you can actually then follow along, and we'll build something fun together. The whole thing is just incredibly ambitious, and I just can't wait to see it. See it debut. There's a lot of work that's been going on and is going on to make it awesome, and a lot of us are heads down, but I can't wait. The core conceit is that we're going to demonstrate as many of the cool things as possible that have to do with using Spring to embrace and extend the platform, as opposed to simply depending on the platform, Kubernetes. We've got a ton of cool stuff lined up in that vein, including a look at Spring Cloud Kubernetes, a look at Spring Cloud Dataflow, writing Kubernetes controllers, and more. And I can't wait. We're also, we saved the best for last, of course, and so the day two, like I say, will be a workshop, and that'll touch on some of these themes, and you can follow along, and that'll be a lot of fun, right? Because you can interact with all of us, and we'll build something fun together, right? It's gonna be awesome. Oh, and did I mention it's free? Register now. It's free. It's gonna be amazing. I've also just had a ton of fun talking to organizations, large and small, about the latest and greatest of the Spring ecosystem. It's been a particularly busy week. I spoke at a few conferences this week. I appreciate that. I love those opportunities. I led a 3-hour workshop for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa on Azure Spring Cloud with my friends over at Microsoft. That was a ton of fun as well. We're doing a third workshop for folks in Asia, too, coming up. I think that's next week, so register for that. It's free, and I'll be there, and I hope we all see you there as well. And, of course, I'm super excited about today's guest, Dilip Krishnan. Dilip works for Oracle, where he works on the Oracle Cloud Lift team that helps organizations modernize their applications. Dilip is also a major contributor to SpringFox, which supports building Swagger applications with Spring. We spoke ever so briefly about SpringFox in a recent episode, and people chimed in, and they wanted more. And so I was so glad when I was able to land Dilip for the show. I know he's crazy busy, and it's super cool that we got him to agree to be on the show. The interview itself was also a really pleasant experience. If I'm honest, I didn't know how it was going to go because he works for Oracle and they're a very large organization. And I don't know if you've ever tried to book a guest from a large organization, but trust me, it's not easy. This was actually really, really easy. It was just great. And obviously Oracle is the benevolent organization that leads a lot of the things that are happening in the Java ecosystem, right? And obviously Java gives a lot of us, myself included, of course, a livelihood. And so while I've always been super grateful for that, I didn't look forward to trying to engage somebody from Oracle because I thought it would be hard. And let me just tell you, I've had way worse experiences. This was really, really cool. I couldn't believe how friendly the whole process, everybody I had to deal with was, and how quick it went and all that. And so thank you, Oracle. Really, 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 really. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thank you, Dilip, for your time as well. And thanks. It's not Thanksgiving. I'm just saying thanks because it was really great. I'm so glad this happened. I'm so glad we got to have this episode. We got to have this interview and this discussion. I'm glad that Oracle contribute to some of the things that we all know and love. And so with that, and without further ado, enjoy, as always, and we'll talk to you next time. Oh, that is so cool. We got to press that record button. I am so excited. Dilip, thank you so much for joining me today. Can you, before we get started, before I just run away with all the questions, can you tell people who you are, what do you do, etc.?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I'm really grateful to be part of this show. I mean, I really appreciate all the work that you do. It's part of the community, and I totally enjoy all the presentations that you come and give in Java Mug, that local to Dallas, where I'm based off of. So basically, I work for Oracle. I work in their North America Cloud Engineering team. I'm part of their I'm part of the delivery engineering, which is something that we've started this new program called Cloud Lift, and we're part of this team which says to our customers, "Hey, we can take on your journey to the cloud." So we help ISVs and cloud native customers. We help them come onto the cloud, whether they are already cloud customers or maybe they're looking for diversifying their risk by moving to other clouds as well, having their workloads distributed, or if they're for other reasons looking to move their cloud because of whatever reason their business demands. So our team is basically here to help customers in that journey. We call that program Cloud Lift. And my team is part of the delivery engineering team that helps do that.
That is super cool. So there's a lot there. Let me first of all, thank you for what you do in the community. And we were just talking about that before we started recording. What you do, you work on something that is critical to the Spring ecosystem. And it's just grown pretty much without, you know, any input from us. And it's just this wonderful thing. So thank you. I love the Java Mug. That's a world-class user group there. And I've been there a number of times over the last decade or so. And so that's cool. I know I think you said we had met perhaps before that. And I was very curious. I was very surprised to realize that you and I were both editors for InfoQ, which is, you know, again, a world-class portal for engineers of all stripes to congregate. And then as for what you're doing, Ed, so you work for Oracle, of course, the shepherds of, you know, Java, the most interesting runtime and ecosystem in the world for software engineers, I think. And so you're doing cool stuff there. And Cloud Lift, that is a cool name. And, you know, obviously I've bumped into a lot of people out there who are using Oracle's cloud. It's awesome, right? It's gotten even better over the years. It's very cool to see that you're doing that kind of stuff. It sounds like you're doing a lot of integration, like a lot of having to do with taking apps that were written in yesteryear and moving them to a more sort of cloud native.
I think really explicit, right? We actually go through this process of discovery, and then we help the customers architect new solutions if they're not really already cloud native.
Cool.
And we also help them migrate their stuff. Like if they have databases that are like on-prem or maybe even a different kind of flavor of database. If they feel that there's an opportunity to migrate their workloads to Oracle Cloud, we are happy to help them with that. And seeing their go lives is what makes us most happy. So
that is so cool. And speaking of the database, another, you know, in addition to all the great work around Java and all that cool stuff, did you see that Oracle just released an R2DBC driver, a reactive relational database connectivity driver, open source? Well, I'm not sure if it's open. They released a driver for this thing called R2DBC, which is so cool. I mean, the community did a collective backflip when we saw that. That was the coolest thing ever. That means there's now a way to do asynchronous, non-blocking database, you know, business logic with the most rock solid database on the planet, you know. So
I think they also did like another really cool thing, I think, was releasing their libraries, the database access libraries in Maven Central, I think. Which I think was not possible before. You'd have to manually go and download it way back in the past.
Even the driver, like the JDBC driver?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They did that a few years ago, but just recently, this year, they did R2DBC as well, which is amazing. Just so cool. And I know that half the battle with anything that of that ambition, of that scope, of that scale is the engineering work, and the other half is just making sure we've dotted the I's and crossed the T's and all that stuff, and they did it. I love it. I love it. Thank you, Oracle. So you're at the front lines of like all these really cool integration projects. And so it's no surprise to me then that you would have a lot of experience there. You'd be doing work on building services, building systems at scale, and all that. And one thing that you cannot avoid today in any discussion of building services is this concept of API schema, of API registries, of API versioning. At the heart of all that, I think, is this open API, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think of it as glue that pretty much allows you to connect systems. It's akin to like technologies in the past, like the WSR, which is the kind of the scary four-letter word from the past. But I think it's come, I think, back in full circle, where people want to have a self-describing way to describe their services, so they can connect different services in different ways. And actually even advertise them. I think a lot of our services are even modeled as open API. So you can actually go and introspect what a service looks like, what the arguments look like to interact with it, and then have those interactions easily as if you have the what do you call the Swagger UI if it's exposed. But yeah, I think what it does is really just accelerate your innovation, right? By having machine readable descriptions of your API.
Against which you can validate that a message you send will actually comply.
There's different technologies for that. I'm not sure if you're completely there. I think the new innovations in open API definitely are getting there. For example, they've included support for first-class support for JSON schema to describe the payloads, which is a great thing. They had in the past versions, fragmented support and kind of hacks, if you will, to kind of model those kinds of payloads. But now with 3.1 of the Open API, they've actually added full support for JSON schema as a description. So I think what it's getting to is just standardizing all these things that enable your tooling goes along with all these standards, and it just makes those integration points much faster because you're working on open standards that are built by standard bodies. Yeah. So
that's, I think, if you look at, you mentioned WSR, and that brings to mind memories of UDDI and the Universal Discovery and whatever something.
Oh my goodness!
I forget. Yeah. And I just remember these Byzantine sort of architecture diagrams that were just nauseatingly complex, you know. And now it's just we're all looking to just take our REST APIs, our RESTful APIs, and make them easier to work with, and I think a lot of organizations at scale, if you see any of their talks, or certainly you and I have seen more than a few going on InfoQ, if you look at these large organizations, they inevitably need some way to advertise and consume services in a consistent fashion across the organization. So, and invariably they also decide to swap out the transport, right? So to a lot of them, the fact that HTTP doesn't have its own built-in mechanism by which to advertise and then consume these services is a limitation, not to mention the then perhaps legitimate concerns about efficiency and throughput and all that. You know, now in light of HTTP 2 and 3, it's less of an issue, I suppose. But back then you could say, well, look, HTTP is slow, it's porous, it's textual, and there's no built-in mechanism by which to advertise your APIs. And so you see things like gRPC from Google, you see GraphQL from Facebook, you see Alibaba has one called I forget what they've got a thing that they've advertised as well, where it's a binary encoding mechanism, and basically these are part and parcel. You've got the way to consume an API, but you've also got the way to advertise and describe and constrain that API. And so the magic of what Open API does is it brings to HTTP, which we all have. It's everywhere. It's pervasive. To me, to my mind, the magic is that it's bringing that last piece, which is HTTP is now efficient-ish. It's more efficient than before, certainly. But now it's also bringing us a consistent, standardized way to advertise.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that's definitely one component to it. There's there's also, like, I think a lot of these technologies work in concert, right? Like, there's not only, it's not only enough to have a machine describable API. You need to have something that humans can consume as well, right? They need to interact with it. If they need to play with the API, for example, and experiment with, oh, what happens when I send this versus this, and see what the responses look like, and to be able to build UIs on top of those interactions based on those experiments.
I think you need
a way to describe it. And I think the really cool technology that that I love in the Spring ecosystem is the Spring Desktops. I think Andy Wilkinson started it, and it was about the same time we were building the Spring Fox library. But I think that's like a great complementary technology that allows you to, like, describe in prose what you need to do to interact with the API. And in addition to that, I think you need to be able to describe it at runtime as well, based on, like, contextually. Like, it's not enough to just do it at, like, you know, the constant criticism that OpenAPI gets is that you have this wall of APIs, right? Like, a description, and then you have to know how to interact. There's no way to describe a workflow. So, for example, so there's always that need to describe a workflow. How do you get, like if you want to place an order for a coffee, how do you get from being at the counter to taking delivery of your coffee? How do you do that? Like, all the different steps in between. There's no way to describe it today. I think OpenAPI doesn't describe it well today.
Right.
And you need something to augment that. You need something like hypermedia. Some kind of hypermedia formats to try and tell you what you can afford, what you cannot afford to do, if you want. And then what are the options?
Transitions.
Exactly. So all of these work in concert to be able to efficiently describe your API and interact with it. And one small piece of it is OpenAPI. So that's just the declarative definition of your API, machine readable API, at the design time. So
love it. Yeah. That's a great, you just answered the question I was about to ask, which is, what would you describe OpenAPI as? And in plain fact, it's just a YAML, it's a document that has a definition of what endpoints exist and perhaps what you can do to interact with them. Is that fair?
Exactly.
And so,
and it does have some ways by which you can give some prose, but it's like the only way you interact with OpenAPI outside of like machines interacting with it to build complex systems is using the Swagger UI, which is the most publicly accessible, the most easily available like window into an OpenAPI description, right? So so I think that is the paradigm of interacting with an API in that fashion is not how normally people interact with an API, right?
Absolutely.
So
for people who haven't, for the one person who hasn't done that yet, the Swagger UI is a visual tool that you can use to explore an API. It shows you all the things that are available. It lets you send a request and view the response and just basically use it as a playground.
Exactly. It is a playground. It's kind of like your REPL for the web.
Totally. That's a great way. It's this very live thing. And when you're thinking of, you know, when you think of binary RPC protocols, that's very hard to do. Right, you can't. It's not easy for human beings to craft a correct message, but with HTTP, in theory, it should be possible. And yet, it's opaque, right? Because you just don't know what's expected at what point in the workflow, you know. And so, having something that describes all of that, enumerates it, spells it out for you explicitly, is magic. You know, really, really, very valuable. The ability to have a consistent way by which we can advertise services, I think, is integral. How did we get here? OpenAPI is a thing that we have today, but that's not what it always was. How did it start? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can tell you my journey in how I got introduced to it. And it's fairly close to how I've seen it in the wild. But basically, this is it started out by this company called Wordnik.
Wordnik. Okay.
Yeah, Wordnik was a company that kind of gave you an API access into like finding synonyms, finding antonyms for words. And
right.
So it kind of had an API for doing that. And so Tony, who was one of the folks, Tony Tam was one of the folks who was, I think he was the CTO of that company. I'm not sure. So he started out by describing the API in what was called Swagger back then. And Swagger, because of its really colorful and fantastic UI and the easy access, the playground that it gives, it's really caught on fire for some reason. You know, some things just like click with the community and then yeah. just catch on fire.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of those things that just became wildly popular. And the time that I got introduced to it was when it was Swagger 1.1 or 1.2. So I was new to the Java ecosystem, and I had just joined a company called the Container Store,
right?
And they were looking to actually make like all the services that run the business be first class services through APIs. And this was the kind of the right time that when I joined the company, we were looking for something to advertise these services. So
right.
So that's when I like Marty, who was on your show in the past,
right?
He built this library, and I looked at it, and it looked like it was really useful and had like pretty much a lot of the functionality that we needed to actually introspect the APIs and build those things. So what started out by Marty is like it was called Swagger Spring MVC, and
right.
And I was and Marty was really kind enough to let me contribute on his repo, and we were we did that for like 6 months, and then we figured that I think this needs like a first class library for it to be like embraced by the ecosystem and be able to allow people to contribute to it. And
yeah.
It cannot be like a person, it has to be an organization that is behind it. So another developer who was with Gradle, Gradleware, Adrian and myself, we started SpringFox, and we pretty much took the code base from Marty, and we from the ground up we started building the library for SpringFox and that was when it was Swagger 2.0 is when we took over SpringFox.
Okay.
And the 2.0 also became really popular. It was still called Swagger. And that's when they realized that in order for something like Swagger to become a popular representation of your API description, it needed to be part of an organization that, like Linux Foundation was something that they picked as one of the stewards for the standard, and then they
right.
picked people to run the standards committee, and they had they picked people to actually be part of the working group.
Yeah.
So that was how Swagger actually became open API and got under the stewardship of the Linux Foundation for the yeah, what it is now is
the administration of this
yeah,
project.
Exactly.
Now it's we're talking, of course, about your contributions to the Spring binding, the Spring integration for the Java ecosystem's support, right?
Mm-hmm.
Separate and apart from that, however, is that other languages and other runtimes also have support for Open API. So
sure,
people can use it with Node.js. They can use it from .NET, they can use it from virtually any platform out there. It's not just the JVM that
Correct.
Benefits from it. Yeah. And it's really, it's taking off. You know, you see, again, I'm starting to see it be just sort of part and parcel of any large organization. They they need to solve this problem. Any experienced architect will appreciate the need for that. This is just a well understood space now with the open API, right?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Like what we have with Spring Fox is just the small window of the JVM and right. that too of the Spring ecosystem. I think really it speaks to the engineering, the Spring ecosystem, which allows you to actually introspect so much that you can actually deliver meaningful API descriptions out of just pure introspection, right? Like one of the tenets of like the design of Spring Fox was to not have reliance on any custom annotations. It would just completely rely on just native Spring annotations to infer API descriptions. So, so that was the design goal when I started out working on it. So I think we've kept pretty true to that. Like we don't really rely on any of the Swagger annotations that like usually you see posts on the web where you have very strongly annotated. Those are just annotations that they're optional and they help. They augment the descriptions that are generated just purely based on Spring.
Right.
So yeah, I think it just goes to show the engineering quality of how versatile the Spring ecosystem is.
And I appreciate that. Obviously, I do, but I think that some of those annotations are quite useful because they plug gaps that Spring doesn't plug. Not because it doesn't. It's just because it's not a gap from the Spring's perspective. But if what you're trying to do is to document an API, then it's useful to have something else. So one example is like a at pattern, right? Pattern allows you to specify that this path or some segment of the URI should match a particular regular expression, right?
Correct.
We from the Spring perspective, we don't need to specify that. It's we just match this and we pass you in the context, you know, whatever that is.
Correct.
But if you want to document from the user's perspective that you shouldn't try and send a date when it's expecting an integer, you know, that annotation can be quite useful, that augmented metadata. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing about like Spring is also one of those frameworks that's lived a fairly long, successful life, right? Yeah. So there's always these decisions that we had in the past in Spring. Like let me give you an example. Like you can choose to annotate something with the request param, or you can choose to not. And it would treat it as either a parameter that you can post or a matrix parameter. It would just work, right? That's what Spring does. It's like there's some amount of magic that happens a lot in Spring. Yep. And so that's where annotations are really useful, is they disambiguate things that Spring can actually handle to make it explicitly clear what exactly the expectation is for things like those kinds of parameters. But yeah.
I love that. That's cool. Yeah, exactly. That's really cool. You know, I was just you mentioned the long life, and I was just thinking about it in what is it, May something? Here, let me just look at this here quick. In May of this year, come on, download sources. May 3, 2001 is when, for example, the JDBC template was created.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So May 3 was, which is a, you know, a couple weeks at most from date of this recording, late April 2021. It'll be 20 years.
Wow, that's amazing. Actually, I do need to do it for to build support. I spelunk a lot of the Spring code.
Right.
And I see a lot of these comments in there, and I mean, it's pretty amazing how neatly, like, you really get to appreciate when somebody says, "I need to polish this commit." You really appreciate when you hear in the talks that somebody needs to polish a commit, you don't really quite realize it except when you're spelunking the code.
Oh yeah, Jürgen. It's about Jürgen in particular. Jürgen Holler.
Absolutely, yeah. Jürgen is like very particular about the quality of code that comes in.
Yeah, there's 20. Think about that. This class JDBC template has grown. It has there's new stuff in it since in the, over the last 20 years, but we didn't have to throw it away. It was just so well written from the get go that it was just it still works. You can still use it very very capably with any JDBC. You know, data access, it's just wonderful. I didn't mean to get off on a tangent. I'm just, I think that's pretty cool, you know? What about, so right now, I was just, you know, in preparation for our little discussion here, I was just going through and I was going through there and I'm looking at the, what is the state of the art there, you know? And it's just really amazing how far it's come because Spring itself, I just mentioned that Spring has been around for a long time. Building an HTTP application 20 years ago in Spring looked very different than it can look today, right? So I just think pretty interesting how
so
it's
I think,
grown.
You can see some of that in SpringFox. So while it initially only supported Spring MVC, people have a way of asking for support for even like just the Forms API, right? Like they want that, they want support for the new functional APIs. They want support for the new reactive APIs.
Yeah.
So there's also, the support for all of those in SpringFox. It's just that the reactive side of it has not really gotten much love recently. Sorry about that.
What was that?
That was my dog again.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about that.
No problem. Okay, cool. So
there you can splice it again.
No problem.
So the reactive side of it has not gotten as much attention as it should. But part of that is because there's also this, in addition to OpenAPI, there's also this API called Async API, which actually allows you to describe APIs that are reactive.
Right.
And so there's always this tussle. Do you force fit like a reactive API into something that's like describing just a request response kind of API? So there's always that tussle, and I've been kind of on the fence about how much support that needs to be added to that. But sounds like Async API has become really popular too, and it's come under the fold of Linux Foundation as well. So there's some synergy that's going to happen, I'm sure.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what happens. So what is the experience then for people who are building it? Like, what is the use case that you imagine happens? What's the scenario for your average everyday user of SpringFox, right?
Sure.
Where do they start?
So we follow the same pattern as some of the Spring Boot starters.
Okay, so it works with Spring Boot. That's cool.
So you just drop in a library and it's a starter library, whether it's reactive or whether it's a regular Spring MVC web MVC application.
Right.
You pull in the appropriate starter and that's it. Everything should just be wired up and you should be able to see your APIs as soon as you start it up. You shouldn't have to do anything.
I see that it supports reactive APIs, traditional servlet APIs, and even the functional reactive style, right? So I can do a
functional reactive style is a little bit very primitive right now. It's not it's not fully built out, but it does support basic annotated. It doesn't support functionally defined APIs, if you will.
Oh.
So if you define your reactive APIs as just regular annotations, like if you just do a request mapping, and if you have a mono or a flux based API, it will support it.
Right.
But if you define your APIs as a reactive API, as a functional style definition.
Function?
Yeah, so we don't support that fully yet.
Okay. Oh, because I saw one of the demos earlier. There was a, I assume that worked for the greeting something rather in the demo.
Yeah, I think it works for the, like, pretty much the experience is you just drop in an, a starter library and it should just work.
Okay.
That is the experience that we're going for. Yeah, also to keep in mind, right that this is like, there's two aspects of this open API thing. Like,
right.
Do you do like code first or do you do API first? And we follow the code first. So we believe the code is always the truth. And right. We try to represent the code as a, as an API description. There's always the other way of doing it. You define your API and you generate your stubs.
Yeah.
And that's a different way of working it. You don't need Spring Fox for that.
Right. Yeah, that's just, you provide it and you need something to connect it to link them.
Good.
That is so cool. I love that you've got already basic support for all these different things. You've got great support in some cases because some of these use cases are more well understood, well entrenched, you know. What's the future look like?
So the future is really like one of my goals initially when I started it many years ago was to actually build out a hypermedia format. So to be able to give you contextual API descriptions and not just this like this wall of APIs, if you will.
Right.
So the idea is that you have an API that you interact with and it gives you back what we call controls.
Right.
And we haven't defined a media format for that, but the goal always has been that there should be a way by which you can actually pass in control along with data and be able to introspect controls to see your next actions. There's definitely some cool work going on and in that particular area, and some folks have reached out to me and they're working on it. But I haven't had bandwidth to really work on it, but I'd love for like some community, if they're interested, please reach out to me and I'd love to chat about it and add support for it.
Right on. So that's a great point, actually. Where do people go if they want to like contribute or learn more or whatever?
People can actually go to springfox.io. Or they can reach me on my Twitter handle. Dilip Krish is my Twitter handle, DilipKrish.
Cool.
They can always reach me there. And I think the repository also has my email. So I'd rather not share that because
it's okay. The bots.
So.
Right. So right now I've got, so this is the foundational piece. You're working on the thing on which everything else will then build because OpenAPI is the beginning of the journey, not the end, right? From that, you have code generators that can actually generate kind of clients from it. You've got, people that can give you registries so you can search, do discovery. You've got, my goodness, I mean, I'm sure I'm missing 1,000 use cases here besides just pointing Swagger UI to it, right? And exploring it, right?
Exactly.
Amazing. You know, like what are some of the common, where do people go once they've got a system that is well-documented, well-understood?
You mean go for help or?
No, sorry. What are some of the things that people do once they have OpenAPI? What are some of the opportunities that gives you, right? Because you use Spring Fox to integrate OpenAPI into your system.
Correct.
And we talked about how you can use Swagger UI, but what are some of the cool things you've seen people do above and beyond that?
One really common use case is people actually, like a lot of API gateways support natively, they'll just suck in API descriptions and actually do set up your API routes in API gateway. So
So
that's a really easy way to set up your API gateway if you're going to do that. There's different tools that support it natively now. So because it's a machine readable description, really, that's what enables it.
That is so cool, actually. That's a very, very cool use case. I wonder if we have support for that in Spring Cloud Gateway. If not, we should. That sounds very interesting.
That's another interesting thing, that interesting product from the Spring ecosystem is the Spring Cloud Contract, which is another really interesting thing that came out of that. The PAX framework and the cloud, I forget what it's called. The Spring Cloud Contract actually does a really good job of building that workflow. But of course, there's a trade-off, right?
Yeah.
It's the prime use case is when you control the two sides of the API, then this is an ideal way to collaborate and work on evolving your API. So the Spring Cloud Contract is one thing that really works well with that workflow.
Right. Spring Cloud Contract, I think we support OpenAPI as a contract type.
Is that right? I haven't really followed that in a while, but that's fantastic.
Spring Cloud Contract, OpenAPI 3 contracts. So I think so. This is a contract. So basically you can use that to act as the contract instead of a traditional Spring Cloud contract or instead of a PACT contract,
Nice.
Which makes sense. That's a good point. I completely forgot about that. That's a whole other, discussion. That's one of those features where it's just one of the many things that Spring Cloud Contract does for you there. And that's actually a few years old, actually. I think it's a few years old. So I think people could actually use Spring Fox to get their services and get their open API. And then from there, the world is their oyster, right? There's so many possibilities starting
that
with
is great.
Those, some the things we just talked about. I mean, amazing. Okay, really cool. I really, I'm so glad we got to talk about all this. I think there's just a lot of really interesting use cases for this stuff. And obviously I don't know much about it. I was just very happy to see that there's reactive support and there's great support for the Servlet API and Spring Webflux and all that. And that's been there for years and years and years. But it's growing. This ecosystem is getting better and better by the day. So in no small part to your enormous contributions. Where do you recommend people go if they want to, I think you covered this already a little bit, but where do you think people should go if they want to learn more about this project, first of all?
Springfox.io is the place to go. If you want to file any issues, that it just takes you to your GitHub repo and you can file any issues if you need.
Okay.
Stack Overflow is another place that I check fairly regularly for any issues. And of course, you can always reach me by my Twitter handle. There's also a Gitter channel that is part of the project. So if you have something that you need answered, that's another channel to reach out for help. So that's a little bit more interactive. But these are the different channels that if they need to contact and get some help. And of course, if you think you can contribute, I'd love to chat with you about contributing to the project. Reach out to me, and I'm happy to set some time up, and we can talk about how we can get you onboarded.
Cool. And then, am I wrong? I found, just through some light Googling, I found separate and apart from this, of course, separate, I found oracle.com/cloud/cloud-lift. Is that the same thing?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So people can learn a lot more about that really exciting group.
That is the Cloud Lift program. If you want to, what I say to some of the customers is it's free. A lot of the services that's offered in Oracle Cloud is free. And if you think it's meets your needs, please don't hesitate to reach out. We can help you to, of course, do the cloud lift, which is getting you onto the cloud. But definitely don't hesitate to reach out.
And would somebody who uses cloud lift, would they get to talk to you?
Somewhere down the line, yes. Obviously, they would always go through the sales machinery and all that process happens once we get the lead. And then once it comes to something that that a customer says, hey, I think we want to try something, and we want to try a POC out, or hey, I think we want to try something, try doing this small workload and move it to the cloud. That's when we come in and we help those workloads go into the cloud.
That's a deep bench of talent. I would be, I think anybody would be very happy to have access to. So that's super cool. Thank you for that. And finally, any last words? I'm going to just give you the last word here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity to interact with you. Like I'm a big fan of the Spring ecosystem. I'm so glad that I got this opportunity.
Thank you so very much for being here. And likewise, the feeling is mutual. And thanks for all the work you've been doing.
Absolutely.
A Bootiful podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at starbuxman on Twitter, where, of course, my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as it really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from Morning and Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/Josh Long for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.